This episode of Timucua Presents is supported by O2 Pictures. O2 Pictures creates high-quality digital content for businesses and industries throughout Florida and the world. To see their award-winning work, check out o2pictures.com, and we thank them for supporting the Timucua Arts Foundation.
I used to work through my emotions playing my flute and harmonize the moan of the vacuum.
This is Timucua Presents. I'm David McDonald. Lucy Woodward is a singer, songwriter, and producer. And to say she's led an interesting life would be quite an understatement. She grew up in a family of musicians between the United States and Europe, spent time as a teen radio idol, and is now on solid footing as a genuine indie rock star. As you're about to hear, she's also lots of fun and totally charming to talk to. You can hear her striking blend of jazz, R&B, thoughtful arrangements, and powerful singing at 7:30 on Thursday, February 16th at Timucua. Tickets are just $10 for Timucua members and $20 for non-members. You can buy them at timucua.com. That's T-I-M-U-C-U-A.com. And while you're there, you can become a member to get that discount. And while you're at your computer, it would be awfully nice of you to rate and review this podcast in iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also let me know what you think of the show on Twitter, where I'm at Dave McDo, D-A-V-E-M-A-C-D-O, or my email at podcast@timucua.com. And now, here is my conversation with Lucy.
I'm definitely like a soul-based, jazzy influenced with rock and pop elements. I write pop songs, but I have a lot of kind of, some people call me like neo torch, you know, modern day femme noir.
That's a lot of things. Let's,
I don't know what, there we go.
Where does this all come from? How did you get into music?
Well, my parents are both musicians. My mom and my dad are both classical musicians. So my mom was an opera singer and a musicologist, and my dad is a composer, conductor. And everyone in my family, they're all deep in the education system, but they also all play an instrument. So it was kind of like a no-brainer that I was literally born into music. When I was 5, 6 years old, I was playing piano. When I was 7 or 8, I picked up the flute. And then by 12, I knew I wanted to sing. So it was just kind of a very natural, weird bohemian household of music all the time and dancing all the time and just being creative all the time. So it was, that's really, you know, I kind of had no choice. I still go, God, I hate this music business. I want to quit every day, but what else am I going to do? This is actually my soul, my core. This is what I do, you know?
Yeah, I think I do. I always wonder what it's like for people growing up in a household that is just full of professional, or at least, you know, professional quality musicians.
Yeah.
What kinds of music were you surrounded by growing up there?
Well, I was born in London and lived in Holland till I was 5. And then my parents split and my mom took my brother and I to New York. So I grew up in New York, but my dad stayed in Holland. So growing up in New York with my mom and my grandparents, there was a lot of classical music going on in the house when we were with my grandparents. But my mother, besides her doing her opera scales every night and, you know, hearing her practice Queen of the Night, my grandparents listened to a lot of, you know, Chopin and a lot of ballet type music because I was doing a lot of ballet lessons. But my mom was also, crazily enough, a belly dancer. And when we were in Amsterdam, she had picked up, like, as a fun kind of thing, she's like, I'm going to go learn how to belly dance with all of her friends. But when in the divorce, she realized that she could actually, like, make a living doing it while she got her teaching degree, which is, she was already a musicologist. So she kind of said, okay, I can like kind of help pay the bills by throwing together this, you know, this like belly dancing act. And she would do weddings and kind of like birthday parties, very, you know, kind of conservative, nothing too strange or strippy or anything like that, you know, but a lot of family events. And she created this persona with a wig and a stage name and a eye makeup. And I think that it was kind of the first introduction to me watching like a showgirl in a way be, you know, and just watching her life, pack the bag, make sure all your costumes and fake eyelashes, everything are in the bag, go to the gig, come home from the gig, that kind of thing. Where my dad, I would go visit him in the summer and I would stay there for 4 or 5 weeks at a time. And he was remarried to another Dutch opera singer. And so when I would go there, he knew the power of study and he knew that he would kind of give me my own music room. And I would just kind of hang out there all month and just practice and like shed and do all my scales and learn songs and write lyrics out to songs and write new lyrics for myself. And it was like, it was more of like a really deep rehearsal space. That was kind of high school. So they both had really different elements of how they raised me with encouraging music, giving me my own space and inspiration to do that. Interesting.
This is a really interesting collection of sounds that you had in your ears at that time.
Yes, 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 yes. Very much. Yeah. Because like a lot of me, I actually remember a lot more Middle Eastern music more than classical music. I think because I remember my mom was practicing dance all the time. So I'm very like Turkish beats and, you know, Arabic, this is the Arabic language all the time in the house is like so quirky. Like no one has a household like that. It's the weirdest thing ever thinking about it, you know?
Especially adding that to the Mozart opera stuff. And, you know, I don't know what kind of music your father was writing, but it's got to be, you know, at least those three or four completely different kinds of music that are happening. I wonder how much of that do you carry with you today?
It's interesting because they're neither of them are jazz, pop or blues people. Like none of them. My dad, of course, listened to the Beatles because he's English. And my mom did the Beatles because she was an American kid and, you know, growing up at that time. But as far as anything outside of that world, like they didn't do soul, they didn't do blues, they didn't do jazz. So it's weird how I really connected with that and did my own thing. And thank God they let me just do it. It wasn't like, you have to be an opera singer.
Well, but how did you get into that stuff? If it's so different, how did you first encounter it?
Well, I guess the first time I ever sang with a jazz band was in high school. And I had to sing When You Wish Upon a Star. I went to high school in the Bronx. And it was a jazz band where they said, do you want to sing with this band? It was probably my first time singing with a band. I'd already done studio work at that time, around 14 or 15. But when I was 16, the jazz band said, will you come sing this song? Because I was a soloist in the choir. And for whatever was going on behind me, I'm sure it was the horns that inspired me. I just said, this is what I want to do. And I think it was something about singing with a massive ensemble. Later on, I sang with like orchestras and string sections. And I think I just like the power of, and harmonically what's going on behind me. I found that really interesting, especially singing jazz standards where you're singing like this straight ahead melody, whether it was whatever, My Funny Valentine, and just sing the melody and everything else is going on harmonically around you. I loved kind of sitting in the middle of all that. But when I was about 19 or 20, I learned how to sing, you know, jazz standards in coffee shops and little tea rooms around and Italian restaurants around Manhattan. So that was how I don't think I was very good, but I knew that I had to kind of do that to get better. So it was a weird calling because I just don't think I was awesome. I was just like, you just have to do it. I just know it was something I had to do to get better and kind of cut my teeth on. So I think I just loved the music. I didn't grow up with it, but I just loved Ella Fitzgerald and Etta James and later on Aretha Franklin, you know, and then eventually when I got into songwriting, I was just more into the Beatles and Sheryl Crow. It's just very, very massive, you know, variety.
I love your story of just kind of going for it. So often we talk to people and they're like, how do you get into like what, it doesn't matter what it is. How do you get into it? And so often the thing I want to tell them is to just do it. Like there's nobody stopping you. Just start doing it if it's something you feel strongly about.
Yeah. And it's also, it's, you know, I grew up in the Bronx in high school and moved to Manhattan to go to Manhattan School of Music when I was about, I actually skipped my senior year of high school to go there. Or I sort of did my freshman year of college and my senior year of high school at the same time. But I was automatically in a dorm full of musicians. I was already watching all my peers and friends just go do gigs, you know, and I knew that all I had to do was ask someone, hey, I need a good drummer who can play with me, blah, 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 you know, and you're just a phone call away from anybody getting whatever band you wanted or whatever, whoever was available, whether they were good or bad. So it's not like I grew up in a town where nothing was accessible. Everything was like super easy. And I was just in a deep community. You know, so it didn't, nothing kind of held me back. Like, oh, I don't have a band. I don't, you know.
So was it those jazz gigs with the college friends and college roommates that led you to the kind of more blues and rock kinds of sounds?
I think, you know, eventually I met someone who basically put a guitar in my hands and said, this is like how you play an E chord. And from there, I kind of phased a little bit out of the jazz world, realizing I want to write pop songs. I actually have things to say and I have titles and I have lyrics and I like rhyming words. And I don't think I was really great yet, but I started learning how to craft a song. And that was a whole new world for me. So then I just got more into like, I'm going to have a pop rock band and then played different clubs and really just didn't do any jazz standards for many years. And then, you know, trying to get a record deal and all that and getting almost signed and not quite signed and getting almost signed again. And then that led me all the way up to like 2002 where I landed my first record deal. But it was many years before that of just cranking at it and just writing songs and writing more songs. And, you know, at the same time, I was also making a living at that time by singing. So I was singing a lot of jingles. I was singing in cover bands, in wedding bands, singing backgrounds for people. So I knew that I was on the right path of making music. I was already making a living. I'd gotten off waiting tables by the time I was 21. So then it was just a matter of like, you know, let's get out of the wedding band scene and let's start making some art, you know? Yeah. And that took some time.
Should I let myself go?
Sing covers, you know, I do Nina Simone songs, I do Ray Charles songs, just because there's a simplicity in some of these songs that I could never even write. There's a feel, and also everyone loves covers, but there was maybe one record that I did that I was like, I don't want to do any covers. I want to write everything. I just want to, but then I realized, you know what, you can't necessarily write some of these. These songs should be heard again. If you can do your own version of them, you know, why not? I guess I kind of let go a little bit. As you get older, you get a little less precious about what you're putting on your records. Everything is important, but you just kind of go, what's the big deal? Sing a cover, you know? But I think the transitional, I remember specifically after my first record came out on Atlantic Records in 2003, I was really thrown into this, you know, world of top 40. I had a song called on the radio called Dumb Girls, and I did like Jay Leno and Tour Japan, and it was Nickelodeon a few times, and very, very young audience. And I remember everything happening really fast. And you know, and on the road all the time and doing radio shows at like 6 a.m. kind of thing. And I got so burned from that world, not from exhaustion, but just kind of keeping up with the Joneses, who are really like 11-year-olds. And I was like, what am I doing? I sing the blues. It was very strange for me to be singing for that kind of crowd. But that was what was my market was and what the label had thrown me into. You know, it's like no one's fault. And it's not even, I don't even want to use the word fault. It was just sort of, that was the way that game rolled.
And yeah, you just kind of get some momentum in that direction, yeah. And it's hard to stop.
Yeah, it's not like that's just what the following, that's just what happened, you know? And so, but I remember a huge transition for me was my friend Jamie Houston, who is a producer. He wrote all the High School Musical music. He's written a lot of country songs and some songs for Macy Gray and Jessica Simpson. He called me, we'd written a couple of songs for that first record together, and he called me and he said, I'm working on this movie soundtrack called Ice Princess, and I have this song. It's the Bjork cover. It's Oh So Quiet. It's a big band swing tune. I think it's totally up your alley. There was another artist, a very big artist, who had already gotten that gig. But he goes, I need you to send me an acapella of you singing this song because this is your song. Like, you need to do this. And I knew the song already. And so I got the gig and I flew out to LA and I literally was in the studio for an hour because I already knew the material. And I remember I just gotten over bronchitis, so I was really nervous that I wouldn't be able to sing it. But this Bjork song is a lot of screaming and swinging and singing loud and singing really quiet. And during that recording session, I said, I just knew it. I was like, this is what I need to do. I need to use my whole, you know, everything that my voice can do in my material. Why do I feel like I'm trapped in this like pop rock commercial world? I'm not on that label anymore. Screw it. What do you want to do, girl? You know? And I remember specifically in that recording session, I said, I want to sing with strings. I want to sing with horns. I want to sing with really cool arrangements that can let me do my thing. And it was specific. And then from then on, I just knew that would be the sound. Whatever record, whatever song, that would just be a big part of what I did.
It seems potentially kind of risky to make that decision after the kind of career that you'd had.
Yep, but at the same time, I'd already been dropped. No one was playing my song on the radio anymore. Started building a fan base. I was like, maybe no one cares. I'm just going to do my thing. And the fans who like me, they'll just roll along with me. And if they don't like what I'm doing next, so be it. I can't just make music for... You just never can please everybody. You got to do it for you, and you're the only one who is making it. You know, it's a lesson that took a long time to kind of learn. Even though I think deep down I already knew the answer. You know,
you said you released your first album in 2003, mm-hmm. and it's now 2017. You've got four albums out, and mm-hmm. your music, by your own story, has changed pretty significantly from that first one to the second one. What's different now? What is it that inspires you now and drives you to try new things today in 2017?
Musically, this record I loved. I was very inspired by horn arrangements and low brass arrangements. That's what I really wanted to, not every song, but there are quite a few. It's a lot darker. It's a lot richer. It's a lot more raw. And so I wanted to kind of make this record that was a bit, you know, dark coming from the band and the brass arrangements. But then having this very feminine vocal kind of float over the top. That was kind of, I like that dichotomy of the masculine feminine thing. So musically that was kind of what we were going for. But also now, you know, there's, you know, I'm independent artist, but I'm signed to Ground Up Music, who has Snarky Puppy and a lot of amazing artists, and they're signed to Universal Records. So you have this like crazy, beautiful musical community, but there's also no budget for anything. That's just the music industry in general. No one's buying records. Everything is streaming. It's hard to make a living as an artist. So you rely on shows. You rely on merch. You rely on people buying CDs at your shows, and hopefully all things go well from there. So back in the day, in 2003, you know, I had like $1 million budget. You know, I think it cost $500,000 to make the record and another $500,000 to maybe mix it and master it. And then there's $1 million video. And then you put the band on the road for another couple hundred grand, whatever it is. So you're coming from a world knowing what that was back then. And then my next record in 2008 was independent. So that was using all of the royalties from my first record to make that record in my basement. And the next record I did on Verve Records, which was a much smaller budget, but it was funded. And this one was all, you know, I paid for on my own. So it's, yeah, but distributed by a major. So there's, so I've dealt with like every kind of aspect of how to, you know, the record making industry kind of, you know, kind of seen all sorts of aspects, and it gets more and more creative and more easy to make a record. But obviously there's just, it's always a budget thing. That's the thing that keeps you from having a massive horn section on the road with you at all times.
Yeah, that would be nice. There's some really beautiful instrumental playing on some of these tracks, and it's something that I think is really missing from a lot of popular music today, is, you know, like real human beings playing instruments and making sounds. And like, even when it's really in one of the really cool things, one of the tracks that you shared with me is really transparent. There's very little going on. And that is like the kind of risk that I don't think a lot of modern singers would take. You know, you mentioned a few, like you mentioned Nina Simone earlier, and you know, she's the kind of person that might sing something like that, but I can't think of a ton of other people who would take the risk of just hanging out there with bass and drums.
Well, for me, my husband, right? I know. Yeah, I mean, Nina Simone, I've heard the song years ago, and it's her kind of just kind of be my husband and now. And she has always had percussion players on stage, whether they're playing percussion or they're just doing stomps and claps and kind of cool versions of that. Every performance is different. And she's very understated, so she might be almost whispering it. And I remember throwing it into my set a long time ago, and I was like, I'm just going to sing it out. I hadn't heard a girl do it like that. I hadn't even, the only people who I had heard do it were maybe Damien Rice, and I think Ed Sheeran did it, but I hadn't heard a female do it. And I certainly hadn't heard anybody sing it like kind of bluesy and ballsy like that. So it felt right to do, and it works really well in our set. I think, I have no idea. That's what they tell me.
You mentioned that the process of making a record has changed. It seems like, though, that you are in a trajectory of getting more authority, more control over the sounds that are on the record, at the same time that you're also learning more about making good records and learning more about what kinds of records you want to make.
Yeah, for sure.
What are some of the things that you get to do on your most recent record that you're particularly proud of that you wouldn't have been able to do before?
Well, I think in making a record, the first thing is having, obviously, besides material and songs and musicians, that's, you know, but it's having your producers who you really trust. And I've worked with a lot of different producers my entire life, and there are some amazing ones who just like help you grow as just a singer and as just a human being. And then there are other ones who don't do that at all. But my two dear friends, Henry Hay, who's a longtime friend and pianist and arranger. He's incredible, friend of for 15 years or so. And then Michael League is the bass player of Snarky Puppy and bandleader. And us three all had been on the road together. We had all done a bunch of tours and shows and just hanging. We're New York friends. And so when we decided to do this record, it was, you know, a lot of trusting each other with ideas and knowing that there was no label showing up at 3:30 to quote unquote pop by to the studio to see how everything is going to make, you know, see how everything is going to make, you know, basically to, they want to get out of the office, but they also want to, they want to have their say in how this record is going. So there were no rules. We could do whatever we want. And there was beauty in that. We just all had to trust each other and say, hey, yeah, that feels good. You know what? That's a wrap. Let's move on to the next song. And so that was, we all trusted each other. So knowing that that was the template of making a record, it was a beautiful thing. It took a long time to make because I was also singing background for Rod Stewart on the road. So I would go on the road with Rod Stewart. I would come back and work on my record. I'd go back on the road with Rod. I would come back. So there were, it took a few years to make because of all of our schedules. Mike was touring with Snarky Puppy all the time. Henry was touring with George Michael and doing some work with David Bowie. And so we all had crazy schedules to work out. I also live in LA and they live in New York, but you get through all the logistics. Then you're in the studio and you're making it. And you're realizing how easy it is when you love and trust the people that you're with. And that, and also there's no label to tell you what or what not to do, which is cool. So that was something I learned. When you're in, when you have that kind of like bed there, you can, everyone knows how to push because of the deep friendship, you can push, hey, Lucy, you sound really good singing that. Now try doing a take with absolutely no vocal ad-libs in between your lyrics. No, no oohs, no ahs, no soul riffs, nothing. And that was like really a new thing for me. And they said, just try, so just sing the lyric, just sing the melody, no riffs in between. And I was like, oh my God, that's so weird. I don't, how do I do it? You know? And so I did it. And then when we went back and listened to the take on whatever song it was, listened to the take where I did have ad-libs on it, it just sounded so much worse. It was better just to be simple and have the space in it, let the music, the musicians do the work as opposed to me feeling like I have to fill up space. So there were things like that along the way, the whole time, that pushed me into sometimes better singing is not singing and just letting everything breathe. And that was really cool. It took me obviously a million years to like learn that, but I try to carry that. It works for, not doesn't work for every song, but and obviously live is a very different thing as well, energy wise. But that was a big one for me. I learned that just to trust that it's okay to not sing as well.
Yeah, and it's, I think it's really effective. Now I have to ask, because you've mentioned a few times Snarky Puppy, and I teach undergraduate students, and they think Snarky Puppy is basically the coolest thing going. So I got to ask you about how you got to know those fellas and what your relationship with them is, what kinds of projects you work with on them, and what that's meant to your music making.
Oh my God. They're just, meeting them has changed my life on so many levels. 2011, I would put out a record. 2010, I put out my first Verve record, and I knew I didn't have a big budget to go touring around with. So Henry called in his friend, Michael League, who is the band leader of Snarky Puppy, and said, let's just go out as a threesome, and we'll just get a little car, pack it all in, and drive down the East Coast. And that's how I met Mike, is actually, he was my bass player. And then, you know, we all just started, you know, we did that. We basically learned how to play these songs on the road. I think we only did like a week or 10 days or something on the road. And then I think on a break, I was going to do another, this is cool. Maybe a month later, I was going to do another tour, but Henry couldn't do it. So Mike said, you have to call in my boy, Bill Lawrence, fly him in from London and let's do it with Bill. So Bill would be the piano player who's also in Snarky Puppy. And so I did another 10 days with Bill. And at that point, I think I was opening up. I did maybe 6 dates opening up for Snarky Puppy. So Mike and Bill would play in my band, or play, they would be the band. Maybe a few of the horn players would come on and whatever drummer was there. And then, so I would open for Snarky Puppy, and then they would also be my band. So I did a bunch of dates with that. So that's how I met Mike. He was my bass player. And then he said, come sit in with my my band Snarky Puppy. He was doing a really cool thing called family dinner at a local New York place that we'd all played at called Rockwood Music Hall. And what they would do is invite their friends down, singers, horn players, whatever. But they'd say, okay, give us one or two of your songs, and we will completely rearrange your song. And I call it snarkifying it, because you just have to trust them. There's no sound check. There's no rehearsal. You just kind of get up there and let them do their thing to your song. It doesn't mean they're going to go into crazy like time changes or anything, but if that happens, that's cool too. So I guess they trust you that you trust them. And that's why it's a cool combination. So Family Dinner started from Rockwood Music Hall in New York. And we all, that was just part of this community that they, I was already living in LA. But I'd come back and I was like, well, there's this whole other New York community that I just missed after I moved, and started spending more time in New York again. And at that point, I guess I was going out and opening for them a few times. And then Mike had the idea of putting together a concert of called Family Dinner Volume 1. They got this beautiful, beautiful theater in Virginia, in Leesburg, Virginia. I'm sorry, in Roanoke, Virginia, and at the Jefferson Center, and put together this beautiful concert over 2 days, basically, of 7 singers or so of them snarkifying our music officially on tape. And it earned, Layla Hathaway joined us, and her version of her song, Something, that's what it's called, the song is called Something, it won them the Grammy in 2013, which was super amazing, took them their whole thing to the next level. At the same time, they just don't stop touring. So as long as I've known them, they've always lived in a van. And they've just done it the hardcore, real way. It's been super, super hard, like 4 guys to 1 hotel room kind of thing. And that, I learned so much from that. There's just, you just get on the road and do your thing and love your music and build a community. Build it how you want it to build it, how you want it to be. What community do you want to be a part of musically? And they just designed, what they do is they design whatever they want and make that happen. So it's very innovative and super musical, and there's not a bad cat on stage ever.
Yeah, that's kind of where we started, just kind of going after it, doing the thing.
Exactly. Takes a lot of motivation, a lot of going broke, a lot of all sorts of things, but just being driven by the music. So that, I just kind of got into that scene, and their family there. I just saw them this weekend at big NAMM convention, and it's just a lot of brother love, you know?
So what have you learned musically from them? What do you do? What's different about the music you write from your experience working with them?
I guess specifically is, my God, I mean, I so much, I guess, groove and feel and letting things be on stage, not worry, you know, it's really good to have an arrangement and a tight arrangement. I'm not like a jam band, and I wouldn't call them a jam band either, even though they kind of fall into the jam band world sometimes, but only because, you know, there's a lot of improvising and solos. But I've learned that having tight arrangements, but then like having sections to potentially let anything else happen in that moment, and trusting that that will happen, and knowing that that really could happen. Not every song, of mine. But knowing that if you want to solo and go longer and it turns into somebody, something else, and then a drummer comes in and starts playing some other thing on that, it's okay to let that kind of take that, let that spirit take over. And I really look forward to that every show.
We're talking a few weeks before you come to Orlando, and I should say, you're going to be playing at the Timical Arts White House February 16th at 7:30. I'm curious how your work in the recording studio relates to your work on stage. You mentioned earlier how important touring has become to a lot of artists' careers over the last couple of decades. What does touring and performing in front of a live audience, and especially in relatively small, intimate venues like Timucua, what does that mean to your career?
Well, I love small communities that have a huge arts, community, basically. I love towns that you really do feel that sense of art and music, like a crazy support in certain towns. It's not everywhere, and I wish it was, because I think the small towns do make a difference. That, you know, people are working towards building that community. Keeping music in the school system is one of them. After school programs, that's just an education alone. And then, but I find certain towns in North Carolina have that. Little towns in Seattle, Washington State that I played at have that. Obviously, Orlando. And I find that there's an innovative new way to make things happen where the community is involved. I can't describe it. Every city is so, or every town is so different, but a lot of it obviously comes from funding and support from the town or individual people to sponsor these concert halls and small venues. And that's how all of these places, I'm sure. I don't really know the ins and outs of that, but that's how people can keep these incredible art centers and music centers alive, you know, is just by supporting them. I grew up with my grandparents always supporting like PBS and always putting money into the community. So maybe I kind of saw that growing up, and it just feels very much like home to me because it's very genuine as opposed to, you know, getting lost in a shuffle in a huge town. That's why I think smaller towns and small venues, that they do make a difference, because you really feel that within, from the audience. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you get a connection. You can see that the thing that is making the music is not this machine in your pocket or on your desk, but a human being that is really, you know, making these sounds with their body. It's mm-hmm. I think that's what makes live music exciting.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I'm really looking forward to seeing you down here in a few weeks then. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Welcome. Thank you so much, and I'll see you then.
Thanks again to Lucy Woodward for taking some time to join me over Skype to have that conversation. And if you live in Orlando and you didn't already have plans for Thursday, February 16th, you do now. I hope to see you there. My thanks again to O2 Pictures for their support of the Timucua Arts Foundation and this podcast. O2 Pictures creates high-quality digital content for businesses and industry throughout Florida and the world. Even if you don't think you need this service, you really just need to head over to o2pictures.com to see their work. There's just some incredible stuff there, including some totally stunning video from Cirque du Soleil and some amazing stuff from the Animal Kingdom here in Orlando. We really appreciate their support. If you would like to support the Timucua Arts Foundation as O2 Pictures has, by sponsoring future episodes of this podcast, please get in touch with us at podcast@timucua.com. This show is a production of the Timucua Arts Foundation. The executive producer is Chris Belt. I'm David McDonald. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you at the show.